Streaming at you live from their hidden location in their secret lair 10 miles off the beaches of the Emerald Coast. Chimichanga Talk, brought to you by Beach Bum Comics, with your host, Deadpool Speaks, and the Great Wang. And welcome back. We are back for another round of podcasting. I can't believe we've been on the air for this long. Chimichanga Talks brings to you, as always, Deadpool Speaks, and with me,
the Great Wang.
There you go. And we'll start off this special episode by saying this. Great Wang, guess what? We are in 3D.
3D?
3D. Yes, we are.
Let me put on my glasses.
There you go. I already got mine on. I wore these things to sleep. I was so excited. Now, this particular episode is brought to you in 3D by the good people at 3Dnomics. 3Dnomics is a company I just made up.
Yes.
Now, we're going to go ahead and move on into the news. First things first is a little bit of sad news coming out of Baltimore this morning. Actually, at the age of 66, famous military espionage writer and military science novelist and co-founder of Red Storm Entertainment, Tom Clancy, has passed away.
Yes, I heard that. That, again, is just coming through right now. But, you know, he wrote really good books. He didn't have a whole lot of his movies that transferred to film, but I think it had to do with him being such a good writer. The details and espionage and just the specifics that he put in there. And he had a lot to do with the gaming community as well.
Exactly. Actually, a lot of his properties included games like Rainbow Six, Ghost Recon, Splinter Cell, and War and Hawks. And not only that, recently he released the Splinter Cell Blacklist, which is a popular game. And he actually still has one more game out on the horizon out there and coming out in 2014, and that's Tom Clancy's The Division.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of hype behind that. It's going to be fantastic.
And even though it saddens us greatly to lose such a great author, Tom Clancy will be missed. Breaking news out of Baltimore. Now, do you have any other news there, Wang?
Well, I think one thing we have to address is the government shutdown. We all have a lot of friends who are in the, you know, they have connections to the military, you know, and it's really affecting the people who work, you know, at our national parks. They work for, you know, people in the government. So I have a friend of mine, and she fixes PCs for guys on the base in another state. And you know, they just told her not to come to work Sunday afternoon. They said, don't come to work until we tell you otherwise. So that's a shocking thing to hear. And, you know, she's not getting paid or anything. So it's, we just need the government to get together, have a, you know, let's solve this problem. Stop with the petty differences. Let's run this country like a business as opposed to, you know, running it as two separate companies, as I like to call it.
Exactly, and that's really important. And you know, a lot of people forget to think that, you know, a lot of our government employees, which rely heavily on you know, our taxpayers' money and everything else. And what they're doing is they're creating this, you know, furlough day. They're saying, well, you know, we want you to come to work. We want you to work for us for free. We're creating a huge uproar for, you know, this government shutdown. And the thing is, we're a laughing stock, really, amongst other countries, because we really can't get this stuff together.
It's like looking at the kid on the playground. Yeah, he can beat you up, but his parents are a bunch of losers.
Good analogy. You know, and, you know, going from a bunch of losers to a bunch of winners, let me tell you about Breaking Bad. You know,
yeah.
We're looking at now this winner, and I say that in all terms, because believe it or not, Breaking Bad season finale hit some of the highest numbers ever. Actually, 10.3 million viewers with a 5.2 rating among adults 18 to 49, which is it's phenomenal for any show.
Yeah, I mean, and it's just further proof that the cable networks and Netflixes of the world, I mean, they're producing shows that are of superior quality to the networks, you know.
Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, the Emmy Awards a few weeks ago proved that, because very few shows, with the exception of sitcoms, you know, were nominated. And, you're talking one-hour dramas. You can't beat AMC or FX or, you know, Netflix. They just, HBO, Showtime, you know, they produce the best shows.
And believe it or not, Netflix is becoming a real big contender because before, they weren't even considered, you know, for any of these. And you have shows like House of Cards and, you know, Orange is the New Black, which will be able to be nominated next year. For, you know, their possible Emmy because, you know, they're producing shows that are pushing boundaries, shows that people want to see.
Yeah, when you're on one of those networks now, you get my attention. I mean, I read something recently that there's going to be a new show on HBO in 2014, and it's going to star Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, two Hollywood heavyweights who are committing to at least one complete season, if not two complete seasons, of this new drama on HBO. So when you're talking about major Hollywood actors, they're not going to network TV, you know, they're going to cable. So that means that's where the good writers are, that's where the good directors. One of my favorite directors, Tim Van Patten, he's directed a lot of Boardwalk Empires, a lot of Sopranos, which is where it began. All of this good analogy of TV, we can go off the script. You know, it started with the Sopranos in the 90s. So, you know, it's good. In Breaking Bad, the finale was fantastic, you know.
And, it was.
It ended at the right time. Didn't go on too long. Didn't, you know, they could have easily had another season in there. But, you know, it's good. You know, it was time.
And this is one of the things that I respect, you know, about Vince Gillian and stuff like that. He didn't cave into the pressure of saying, well, you know, this is all about the money. No, this is about the story. This is about, you know, this is how long the story is going to take to tell. We don't need to extend it out. Every episode was relevant to the story that they're trying to tell about Walter White and his ascension into this kingpin role and then just, you know, the slippery slope.
And I also urge people, you know, I mean, it's funny, we live in a world now where when you wrap a series, no matter what it is, and, you know, they had important things, people will always remember The Last MASH. That's sort of where it began in the 80s, was with this, hey, you know, the guys are leaving, and now they're never going to see each other again. So the problem is that we always focus on that finale. You know, people go, you mentioned The Sopranos, they go, oh, the last show sucked. Well, I don't think you have to judge a show by its entire catalog, and the thing about Breaking Bad, yes, the finale was fantastic, but the whole series, beginning to end, was a great show, you know?
Exactly.
And I think that's where, you know, I know there's some people who weren't happy with the ending of Dexter. There were some people, Sopranos, Lost, whatever. I always take that with a, you know, grain of salt and go, hey, look, what was the show about? Was it good? And with Breaking Bad, it was definitely good.
And that's one thing that I think that a lot of people were actually happy about is the fact that we got closure. At the very end, it wasn't left up to the audience to decide what, you know, what had happened or you know, it's like, oh, let the audience make up their mind whether this happened or that. No. It basically sealed the deal. It said, okay, this is what happened with this character. If you haven't seen it yet, I'm not going to give it away. But it basically, it tells a story from beginning to end. It's like a book. When you finish that book, you know, unless, I mean, you know, obviously it's a series book, but when you pick up a book, a novel, and you read it from cover to cover, you expect it to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's what the series is.
Yeah.
Perfectly scripted. I heard you got some Star Wars news for us.
Yes, you know, the geeky that I am. I want to preface this by saying it's sort of Star Wars news. You know, it's one of these things where, you know, all these, Hollywood types, the paparazzi especially, and news organizations, they like to stir up these rumors. And anytime I click on an article that says rumors, you know, let me see how valid this is. So I just thought everybody would get a kick out of this if you haven't read this. So there was a headline in a news article that circulated for the past few days, and it said Daniel Day-Lewis to be in the next Star Wars film. So I was like, well, this would be interesting, you know, I mean, you know, great actor, you know, and the more I looked into it, the more I read about it, they're saying, this article is saying he's going to be in the next Star Wars film, mainly because on this past weekend, he was photographed by the paparazzi having lunch with George Lucas.
What?
Now the last time I checked, I don't know many actors who, you know, auditioned while eating a panini, but, I guess if Daniel Day-Lewis was eating lunch with me, they would have taken a picture and went Daniel Day-Lewis with unknown person.
With an unknown person possibly in Star Wars.
possibly in Star Wars. You know, so it's not really news because there's been no official announcement that he's even auditioned or that he's going to audition. It's like, you know, and before people start, you know, talking about all these rumors, you know, let's make sure there's some, you know, valid points.
Well, do you know anybody else who's had lunch with George Lucas who's rumored to be in Star Wars?
Again, you know, I don't have any proof. Now from a specific standpoint, you know, they've also, the Hollywood trade papers, no one in specific because they're all kind of jumping in, trying to figure out who's in the new Star Wars film. So they've listed Ryan Gosling, they've listed Zac Efron and Benedict Cumberbatch, and a lot of people are being tied to the film. But, you know, I'm here to say, and again, this is breaking news, so I want all of this attributed to the Great Wing.
Now remember, you heard it here first.
That's right. So feel free to rumor all you want about your friends. I've heard that Marlon Brando might be in it. Rock Hudson. Yeah. And these guys
Hudson.
They've been dead years, but apparently they might be in the next Star Wars film.
Well, you know what wound up happening is probably somewhere along the line George Lucas shot them to be in some of the other ones, but he hasn't digitally inserted them yet.
That's true. You could take those old films, you know. I mean, nothing like superimposing Elvis Presley from Kid Creole and having him in the next Star Wars film. Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., they could be in the cantina, you know, playing.
There you go. You'd have the Rat Pack being the band in the cantina on Tatooine.
Yeah, you know. And again, this is supposed to take 30 years. The only thing fact we know about this film is it's due to take place 30 years after Return of the Jedi. So Sammy Davis Jr. could play a very old Lando Calrissian. Just saying. Just putting it out there. Well, if you're listening, J.J. Abrams, feel free to use my suggestion.
There you go. You know, Lando Calrissian, Sammy Davis Jr.
A singing Lando Calrissian. That would be awesome.
Oh, wow. You know what? I never thought of Sammy Davis as such a great singer. I'm sorry. Bring on the hate mail.
Here's the deal. Everybody bombard him with a video of the Candyman.
You know, but you know what? I loved him. I loved him in All in the Family.
Yeah. He was funny, you know.
He was great. Don't get me wrong. But, I'd still watch it. Him as Lando, I'd still watch it. You know what? What the hell? Bring in Brad Pitt as a Jedi.
Yeah.
You know?
And here's the thing. Like I said, the whole point of this is, you know, that's great if Daniel Day-Lewis is going to be in the film. But if your credibility is basically saying it's because he had lunch with a director who in no way is going to direct the next film.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, that's like saying he had, you know, lunch with Nicolas Cage, who is in some way related to Francis Ford Coppola, and there's going to be a Godfather 4.
It makes sense. I mean, I heard also through the rumor mill that sitting at the next table was Seth Rogen, and Seth Rogen's actually come in as the new Jar Jar Binks.
Well, again, if he does come in as the new Jar Jar Binks, there's going to be a lot of weed in the film.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure he'll find a creative name for it in the Star Wars universe, but weed nonetheless.
Yes.
Now, one thing that, you know, speaking of weed, one thing I do want to bring up is October 11th. October 11th is right around the corner, and guys, I want you to set your calendars, set your clocks, set your iPhones, set your Android devices.
Set your 80s Atari.
I'm going to bring you this special announcement. Friday, October 11th, Beach Bum Comics presents Jimmy Jenga Talk, Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse. No, it's the Zombie Apocalypse. With your host, me, Deadpool Speaks, and
The Great Wang.
We're going to be providing zombie tips, zombie survival techniques, and great, great advice on how to survive the zombie apocalypse.
You think you know about surviving? You know nothing.
You know nothing. And let me tell you something, we're going to take it back to school. Not new school, not middle school, but old school. Survival techniques from military experts. We're going to have past guests come on our show, tell us about their zombie plan, and we're going to discredit them all the way. We're going to find everything that we can to discredit your zombie plan, because we want you to have the best zombie plan out there. We're going to go ahead and provide you maps, escape routes, thoughtless entertainment, and all for the price of nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing!
You say nothing?
I said nothing! Beachbone Comics presents Chimichanga Talks Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse! Live! Sort of. Friday, October 11th!
Listening to the guide to surviving the zombie apocalypse in no way guarantees your survival, nor will it help and protect you against the following conditions: early baldness, high cholesterol, dementia, moderate to severe digestive difficulty, bad driving, sleeplessness, insomnia, and food allergy. Listening to the guide to surviving the zombie apocalypse will not improve your ability to make money, pick up chicks, learn to swim, eat better, or lose weight. This offer is not valid in Quebec, Vermont, Bolivia, or any resident of any city living beginning with the letter Z.
Today, actually, we have a very special guest on, and because of this special guest, because of who he is and what he does and all the trends that have been going on, we're actually doing this podcast in 3D. You got that, Wang? 3D.
3D. Awesome.
Yeah, not 2Ds. We're going the extra mile because this is such a special guest. We're going to go ahead and do this whole podcast in 3D. So if at home you got your 3D glasses, you want to put them on right now as I introduce to you the great Kevin Porter.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Fantastic. Now, Kevin, look, as I'm pointing the mic out towards you, whoa, we're in 3D. Now, let me go ahead and start by saying this. You are an amazing Batman. People have petitioned for you to play Batman. You are iconic in the geek realm. Now, you didn't get your start with Batman. You actually started in the business. You're from Louisiana.
Yeah, New Orleans.
Tell me, how did you get started? How did you get started in acting? Was it something you always wanted to do?
Well, it's something that I always wanted to do in elementary school, high school, but I never really had the courage. I was a football player. And it's very similar to Glee, and not a lot of times to do the group's mix. It wasn't until I went off to college up in South Carolina, and I was able to get away from the friends that I'd grown up with and those cliques and those groups that I got into theater. And I played football in college. I was very fortunate in that regard. But also, I got very heavily involved in the theater, and from that point on, I knew that that's what my calling was, and that's what my future was.
Now, if anybody has seen you, and I'm pretty sure since everybody at home is enjoying this in 3D, you have an amazing physique. I can see the whole athleticism. I don't see people messing with you if you said, hey, I kind of want to try theater. I definitely, knowing if I was walking down the hall, I would not challenge that.
Well, you should have seen me in high school. I was all mullet and elbows. Just I was very tall, very thin, athletic, but I didn't fill out until probably my second year in college. I wasn't as outgoing as I am today.
Now, did you still have a mullet in college, or?
No. The mullet went away. Probably went away the first year when the coach said, "Son, you need to get rid of that."
Wang actually still has his mullet. He puts it on occasions when he can get the guy to come in and do the weave.
Very so dirt of you, Wang.
Yeah. So Halloween's right around the corner, so I'm getting amped up right now.
So he's pulling that mullet out and strutting its stuff. Now, you went ahead and got your start. You did theater acting. Any kind of productions that we might know of?
Well, I was in You Can't Take It With You. I was in South Pacific. The standards, and the standards are the ones that I love. I love doing original experimental theater, but you just can't beat the classics and the songs and listening to them over and over and performing them and standing in the wings. And that's where my true passion lies is the theater, and only because I just love the classics.
And you know what? You hear a lot of actors actually say that it's one thing being in front of a camera and having all these people there and doing multiple takes, but being live in the theater, it's a completely different experience.
Well, it's like being on the battlefield, and there's no second takes. You're out there. You're getting the butterflies. You've got the energy from the audience. There's no safety net, and so there are no mistakes. And if you do screw up, you learn to push through it, and I use that as a through line and a metaphor for life, because there's no moments to where you can stop and start over. If you screw up, you move forward and you make the most out of it.
And that's actually great. That's a great philosophy to have. So after college, you get out of college, you decide, okay, well, I love theater. Tell me, what did you do next?
Well, when I got out of college, like everyone else, I got a new car.
There you go.
And so with that car comes a payment, and then you get your first really nice apartment, and then you get furniture, and then suddenly you're growing up and you've got bills and you get a real job. So I went to work at Merrill Lynch. I was there for a while and successful, and I really enjoyed it, and I kind of forgot about my dream and my passion and the reason why I consider myself here on earth. And a few years went by, and then I just had an awakening. I had a couple of incidents occur that kind of woke me up, and I said, Kevin, you're not really doing what you were designed to do. You're not doing what really lights your fire, what drives your passions, and what is that? And I had to go back to my college days of playing football or theater. And at that point, there was a point in my life I said, okay, I'm not going to play professional football. I just don't have that skill set. And I said, well, I'd love to act and try acting. And that's when – and this was, I guess, about – 97, 98, that I packed up the bags and I drove out to Los Angeles to give it a shot out there.
And how was that? Because a lot of people, you know, that's actually, you know, a starting story for a lot of people saying, well, I packed up my bags, I went out there, and then suddenly I became a star. It doesn't happen like that.
No, it doesn't. But if you and one thing I always talk about is the journey. And if you appreciate the journey, you appreciate every step of the way and you celebrate the struggle. As long as you're prepared, as long as you're busting your butt, you're doing the right things, you're not getting distracted, the struggle is where the glory lies. And I love the struggle. I surround myself with such a circle of influence that are so supportive that we see success together. We see setbacks, but we know that each step and each day and each failure makes us stronger. So when I came out here, I had my act together. I treated it like a business. I attacked it the way that I would attack anything. And then just day by day, month by month, year by year, you slowly, gradually seek success. There's not a person that I surround myself with that isn't successful in their own right. Are they A-listers? There are some that are really, really successful and highly, highly visible. And there are others that are very happy with doing what they're doing by doing, you know, day roles on soap operas or sitcoms or what have you. And that's success as well.
Now, you talk about that as far as you know, the different meanings of success. Now, you know, I would see you and I'd see you as an extremely successful actor because not only have you've, you know, encompassed a wide field of acting, not theater and you know, the roles that you've played, but you've landed a role that has made you an icon in a particular community, in a group. So you have a very large fan base. It didn't necessarily start with, you know, Batman. What was your first breakthrough as far as, you know, into, I guess, the big leagues of acting?
My first audition that I went on, it was, I was non-union. It was, 2000, I believe, 99 or 2000. And it was for the X-Files. And I was going out for a motivational speaker. And when you're non-union and you're going up against SAG actors, the chances are very slim that you're going to get anything. But I ended up getting a call back, then another one to the producers, directors, and I ended up getting cast in that. And that was a huge coup because it was my first audition out of the gate, and it was my first union gig. And that's what got me into the On-Screen Actors Guild. And that was the one, that's the standard to which I always look back to because all the odds were against me on that one. And I think I had a lot of things in my favor. I had kind of what they were looking for physically, and I was able to pull that off. So that was my breakthrough that got me into the union, and it just happened to be my first theatrical audition as well.
You continued on in television. You did the Hughleys, according to Jim. You did a small stint on General Hospital.
Mm-hmm. General Hospital I was on for, I guess, a year and a half. And I grew up a huge General Hospital fan and the Luke and Laura days and big Rick Springfield fan. And so the opportunity to work on those sets and roam those halls of a soap opera that I grew up watching was a dream come true. And it was one of those reality checks that says, wow, you can do anything. Anyone out there in the world can do anything if they just they put their mind to it and develop a plan, develop a goal, and a roadmap to get them there. Because there I was, this skinny kid being raised in Jacksonville, Florida, watching Luke and Laura after school, And there I am 10, 15 years later on those sets daily doing what I know is being watched by other 15-year-olds at the time.
And that must have been a huge impression on you as far as, you know, getting that feel for how TV works and everything else. I mean, is it as glamorous as a lot of people say? Or, I mean, a lot of people don't understand the work that gets behind having to work on a TV show like that.
I think if you don't appreciate the process, it's not glamorous. But if you do, and if you pay attention and you understand and you love the art and you love the process and you love everything that goes into making a film or making a television show, it is glamorous because there is no downtime. I don't spend my downtime in my trailers playing PlayStation. I'm always on set and I'm watching and I'm paying attention and I'm learning and I'm a sponge and I just want to take it all in. I do have friends and they're good with just hitting their mark, saying their lines, going back and taking a nap and eating and living the high life. And I don't begrudge them for that at all. But I just, everything about the system, everything about the process, I just love, and I think that you'll find that most of the successful actors out here.
Yeah, Kevin, I think you're one of those people who appreciates, you know, the opportunity to witness. I mean, like you said, you take it in, you go there, you see the people who, you know, they're acting, and not even that, but the staff, the directing, and the crew. You know, it's a dedication, a love, really, for the art. It's nice to see someone like yourself who appreciates that, and I know you enjoy watching that unfold as well.
Absolutely. Every time you're on set is an opportunity to learn, and whether it's networking and meeting people, and I don't network for network's sake. I just want to meet people and ask and talk, and again, just pay attention. It's amazing what you learn just by watching an AC, you know, change out a film cartridge or a lens, and you're looking, and then you ask questions, and they're always good with that. They don't mind. If you're showing a willingness to learn and you're just and you're an actor, that's strange to them, but they get a kick out of it.
You know, it kind of puts them in a special role where they're kind of mentoring you in a way. I studied film production, and when you're working side by side with an actor who actually cares about, you know, all the elements that are going into producing, you know, whether it's for television or for film, producing or even theater. Producing it and wanting to learn the craft, it shows that they're, you know, genuine interest. It doesn't – that person also feels like their time's not wasted as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
not they're doing what they're doing. You're just a dude in a room spitting out lines, unseen by no one. Maybe your mother. That's it. It's thousands of people working together as this amazing chain of creativity to bring it from the set into the households. And any breakdown in that chain is catastrophic. And there's no role that's more important than others. You've got your director and your producer and your stars and what have you, which are great. But if you have no one to load the cameras, if you have no one to set the lights, if you have no one to serve lunch, then the system breaks down. So to me, it's a horizontal structure. And everyone's just as important as the next.
You know, it's fascinating when you say that, you know, you like watching them, you like learning. It's not that you're networking, it's that you're meeting people. So you're actually, you know, personifying this whole relationship that you're building with your cast and your crew. Now, you've worn many hats, you know, over the years, writer, director, producer, cinematographer. Has all that come from what you've learned on set?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was actually having dinner with a good friend of mine last night, and I was reminded that they were the ones that encouraged me to write and to direct and to produce, to see the visions that I have and to take control more of my career in that regard. And it was funny because I was wondering when that transition took place maybe 6 or 7 years ago. But I realized how influential that friend was to me, that we encouraged each other to make that step. And all of that comes from appreciating the craft and being on set and looking, going, gosh, I'd really like to do what they're doing, and respecting it, and also respecting your limitations. Sometimes you just can't do things, but you don't know until you try.
Exactly. And do you feel that you've tried everything that there is out there? Or, I mean, are there many other facets of the business that you want to try?
Gosh, there's a point to where I think a wise man once said that a man has to know his limitations. And so, either that's Clint Eastwood, or it may have been from Roadhouse. I don't know. But
that's, you know, that's a big spectrum, but still, it's okay. The statement is valid.
Yeah. So I think that I want to hone in on what I do well, and possibly spread my wings creatively on a smaller scale, but it's push more in front of the camera, what I'm doing now, and direct when the opportunities come my way.
Well, let me ask you, is there anything in particular that you want to direct? Is there like one genre that you prefer over another?
Absolutely. It's character-based, dialogue-driven. I'm not an action guy. I'm not behind the camera. In front of the camera, absolutely. I love dialogue. I love drama. I love character-based stories that tug at the heartstrings and that are about the dynamic of relationships. So that, to me, is my sweet spot when it comes to directing. In front of the camera, I'm built for speed. I mean, action, punching, kicking, what have you. Running, lifting, spitting, throwing, what have you. But that's just the physical. But I think my true nature is much towards the dialogue and the drama.
With that in mind, is there a movie out there in particular that you said, well, I would have loved to have directed this particular movie?
That's a great question, and that happens all the time, because I'm like, oh, there are songs out there that you're like, gosh, I wish I would have written that song.
Yeah.
And I think we all say that. We're like, oh, I wish I could have written that song, because it reflects who you are. And like A Place Beyond the Pines, I'm sure you've seen that.
Yes.
Just a great movie. And that's the type of stuff that I love, because it's about the dynamic of relationships. And I love irony. To me, that is one of the better movies to have hit in a long time. And it went relatively unnoticed. Amazing stellar cast, Bradley Cooper, just a great cast. And if I were to have been able to direct a film, it would have been that.
I think the reason why it went so unknown, it didn't have a large theatrical release, but it did really well in the indie circuit. I mean, I think they toured with it and everything, and I'm pretty sure most people are just discovering it now, even though the movie's been out for a little bit.
I was one of those guys. I saw it on demand, and I was bored, and I'm like, what's that? And I was blown away. I watched it twice that night. Big fan. So
now,
that's funny.
Now let me ask you something. Since you said that, you know, you're obviously on the voyeuristic side of this whole film production thing, do you sit at home watching these movies and do you break them down in your head? Are you like one of these guys that like has a notepad and kind of says, well, you know, I see what they're doing with this. I could have done this better if they did this, or you know, one of those guys?
Well, I applaud any filmmaker, and good or bad. And actually, I'm more of a champion for the smaller filmmakers, because they have less toys, mm-hmm. they have less budget, and they have to do more with less. So smaller filmmakers, and especially like the smaller fan films, and I definitely want to touch on those, they could do no wrong in my eyes. I just want to hug every one of them. So not in a million years would I ever critique them. On the larger end, when I see things and they have the time, they have the budget, they have the resources, and they make these mistakes, it makes me wonder, why are they making these mistakes? Because I give everyone all the credibility in the world. So sometimes you appreciate the things that are done really well, and you appreciate the things that they really drop the ball on. I'm a big fan of the director's commentary. I watch those like crazy. And that's, to me, that's one of the biggest tragedies of the doing away of the blockbusters and the DVDs, is when you have on demand, you don't have the special features. And the special features are basically, to me, I go straight to director's commentary. And if they have a director's commentary, I don't care. I always watch that.
Yes.
Because to me, that's 101 of filmmaking. I just love it. I get so much out of that.
I totally understand that. And I love like a lot of Quentin Tarantino, when you listen to his commentary, and I'm just picking him out of the blue, because I remember sitting down the other night and actually doing exactly what you just said. Sitting down, you know, watching the director's commentary, how he describes everything and how he goes into these rants, how passionate he is about this. You know, and I can see you the same way.
The thing I like about him is he started from nothing. And all of the actors, directors, producers that started from nothing and basically just had to get their hands dirty and made it happen. And when you watch, like, Robert Rodriguez, I'm a crazy huge fan of him. And you watch Mariachi? Is that
Mariachi. El Mariachi.
Mm-hmm. Mariachi, yeah.
To me, you watch that. You watch Evil Dead, the first one. The other two are fine, but you watch the first one. And you, what I would read is Bruce Campbell's autobiography, If Chins Could Talk.
If Chins Could Talk. It's such a great book, yeah.
Amazing book. And that's just, if you want to know about filmmaking, that's what you need to read. You need to read all of Rodriguez's stuff. Because then at that point, the thing I like about these guys is they've taken control of the word yes. and they own it, and they don't make excuses. They raise the money themselves, and it's not a lot of money. They get all of their buddies together. They charge up their credit cards. They make it happen, and it's so much easier now than it was when they were coming up, because now you can make a movie on an iPhone. Anyone that takes control of their own destiny, that has a vision and says, I'm going to make a film, I applaud. And the pioneers, the Sam Raimis, Rodriguez, and this to me is the next generation, the late 70s, early 80s guys. Those to me are my heroes.
And, you know, those are valid heroes, because when you look at some of the stuff that they had to do, like Sam Raimi in particular, and Bruce Campbell mentions it in his book, I mean, he got beaten down because they don't have the fancy equipment. They don't, you know, they didn't have the steady cams. They had to modify and think outside the box.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They were creative. And this is going to segue into the work that I do with the Bat in the Sun guys. And those guys, when I first started with them about 10 years ago, it was Aaron, who was, gosh, maybe all of 17, 16, 17. And it was this kid, and it was his very supportive father, mm-hmm. who had very little more than a nice camera and a ton of vision and passion. And the community, and I'll say the growing empire that they've created as a platform there, and their unwavering integrity is just astounding. And there will be books written on these guys, because where they've grown. When I first started, and it was myself, it was Nicole, it was Aaron, I don't even think Damien was a part of it. It was very small, Bevan, very small community.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the stuff that they're doing now and the stuff that they're growing to do, it's not making excuses, it's not taking no, and it's controlling the word yes. And it's amazing the things that you learn from the most unlikely of all sources. My first project that I worked on them, it was a project called Madness.
Madness.
And then, it transitioned into a project called Legends, which was kind of a teaser, greatest hits of all of Batman's allies and enemies. And that that led into Patient J, which at the time was their Let It Be. That was their Hotel California. That was their be all end all. And through the brilliance of Paul, which is a very dear friend of mine who played the Joker in that, mm-hmm. and Kurt, and just an amazing group of actors, it was extremely well written. And where Aaron and I, we share vision, is we both love what I said earlier. We both love dialogue. We both love drama. We both love suspense. And that's what Patient J was all about.
Working with him, because, I mean, you've obviously worked with Aaron several times now. What is it about the relationship there that from, you know, director to actor that works so well? What do you feel that really clicks between you two?
It's respect. It's mutual respect and contribution and trust. I trust him completely. First of all, he's got a very firm grasp on his vision of the character. And the beauty of Batman, to me, is Batman belongs to everyone. He's American mythology. And so everyone has their view of Batman and how Batman should be. I trust Aaron's view, number one, so I trust his direction. Then, on the back end, I trust that he won't compromise how I myself, as Kevin Porter, an actor, will be viewed. I know that I'll always be spectacular. He'll always shoot me in a way that's just amazing. And I trust him on the production end as well. And he's very open to feedback. He'll run things by me, and I trust him to give him my honest view on dialogue, on scenes, and on the direction of the character.
You know, before you actually started playing Batman, how much research did you have to go into to really grasp this character?
In my case, it's research you're born with, and I was and every person. I mean, I'm guessing a lot of people say this, but I was raised a Batman fan. I was a collector, an avid, huge collector, and still am. And so I had a very firm grasp on who I believed Batman to be. And so you'll see, you can go on the fan page, and you'll see me at 6 months dressed as Batman. And I would run around with, you know, like all boys, with a towel around my neck. But unfortunately, I was Robin because my buddy Donald was Batman.
Now, why did Donald get to be Batman?
Well, he was 2 years older.
Oh. And,
and at the time, I was cool with being Robin. I'm like, okay, Robin's cool. I can handle that. And then I kept growing. I'm like, oh, I'm too tall to be Robin. What am I going to do? And then I'm like, well, I guess I'll be Batman. And so I remember when the 89 movie came out, and I was like a struggling like freshman in college. I didn't have two nickels to rub together. But the Ruby's or the Morris costume came out, and that was like $250. But I had to have it. And so I rushed to the mall, and I don't think I paid for my books that semester, but I had that costume. And I was the hit at the Halloween parties and birthday parties to follow. So the opportunity to portray Batman, and it started when I started working for DC back in, when I first moved out here, 98, 99. It's crazy. It's that long ago. To portray Batman globally, and that's how I really first got into professionally playing Batman, was directly for Warner Brothers and DC Comics.
And what did you do for them?
They would send, let's say Batman was required to be in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and they would say, hey, Kevin, are you available for this date? I'd say, absolutely. Go out there, ride in the Batmobile, and wave to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. Or I would fly to Seoul, Korea for a big mall opening. Or it's amazing just the diverse events that they send me to. And a lot of Comic-Cons. I've for the most part been to 60 or 70% of the San Diego Comic-Cons and New York Comic-Con since 2000, maybe 2000, 2001.
And that's amazing. I mean, that's almost like a fanboy dream.
It is. It's a dream come true. And at no point, as you mature and you grow older and you're no longer 15 or 16, you appreciate the term, these are the best of times. And so I live in those moments, and I live in these times, and I don't let a moment go by to say, you know, I'm living the dream. I started working at Disneyland when the Tarzan movie first came out in 99, and I got all of my character training from Disney. And to me, they train the industry. They're the tops when it comes to character integrity, animation, characterization, just everything. Mm-hmm. And so I take that training, and I worked there 4 years. I also worked at Universal Studios for 7 years. But I took that training and that seriousness and the respect for the character, and I apply it to every character that I portray. And now I'm limited now, self-limiting to Batman. I'll do a couple of others here or there, but Batman to me is the one that is closest to my heart, that I portray the most.
Well, like you said, it's almost like a role that you were born to play.
Well, it's nice being 6'5", having a strong chin.
You know, it's really curious that you mentioned Disney, because like you said, it's a situation where they teach their character actors that never break character. They're never supposed to take, the headpiece off. They're never supposed to break out of character. And they're always going to be, you know, either that princess or that prince or that particular character. Since you say you apply this well, so I guess when the cape and cowl goes on, you're Batman.
It's game on. It is. And one thing that I explained to Aaron when we first shot 10 years ago is I said, Aaron, when the suit goes on, Kevin's gone. And so this nice guy is gone. And I said, I don't want you to think that I'm upset or that I'm angry or that I'm brooding. It's just you have to get into the mode of the Batman for many reasons. First and foremost, it's for the integrity of the performance. But secondly, you just feel silly if you've got that big cowl on and you're just talking like this, and so, it's a little intimidating because I'm even bigger in the suit and I'm pretty quiet. Anytime the cowl goes on, you know, it's like I'm putting Batman as a psyche, as a character on.
How do you get into the head of Bruce Wayne? Like, you know, they say Bruce Wayne and Batman are two totally different characters.
I disagree with that. I think they're the same character. This is very interesting because I talk about this a lot, and a lot of people say that Bruce Wayne is the mask that Batman wears, that he is Batman, and due to the circumstances that occurred when he was younger, maybe even earlier, that they have so molded his life, and he has to put on this character of being this millionaire, billionaire playboy, but that's not really him. He's really this creature of the night. So when I play Bruce Wayne, it's very interesting because you're pretending, and I say that in a very careful way, mm-hmm. to be this cavalier playboy, but you always have to have the darkness underneath that is slowly simmering below the surface and always has to show in the eyes, no matter how dashing or charming that you have to be in those moments, because they have to see almost the danger and the devil inside.
It's almost a reverse analogy, you know, so you could look at it like you're looking at it, Kevin, is that he may be more comfortable as Batman than to be Bruce Wayne, billionaire and out in public.
I don't think there's a single person that studies Batman that would disagree with that. Yeah, I think that that Batman is not comfortable and almost has a certain disdain for the circles that Bruce Wayne runs in.
And I think that the whole reason he does that is just to keep up appearances. And it's interesting how you say he has this whole darkness within him. And, I mean, you can imagine how traumatized as a child he must have been, how everything that he went through. So what you just said basically makes complete sense. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody listening, I'm pretty sure that there might be a couple listening that don't know the whole mythos behind Batman, would now see a different version of Batman, mm-hmm. would be able to see that. Now, how long do you say, once you put on the cape and cowl, I mean, do you basically jump into the character right away, or do you feel like you need a few minutes to kind of really catch it and put in yourself in the mindset, or is it just something that comes naturally?
It comes naturally at this point. It's pretty quick. Once you put that cowl on, you're physically miserable, so it manifests itself pretty quickly. It's restrictive. You can't hear. It's very kind of hard to speak a little bit, and so I think that gosh, who was it? I think that it was Michael Keaton said, just let the suit do the work for you. So, to a certain extent, without being lazy, you embrace the misery. I think also Christian Bale mentioned that as well, that being uncomfortable in the suit added to his sheer anger.
Yeah. Now, you'd think that having all that money, he'd be able to tailor something nicer. But it's not about accessibility and how easy it is to move around in it. It's about the symbol, mm-hmm. what it represents. Right now, more than ever, in the eyes of hundreds of thousands of people, you are Batman. Do you feel like it's a lot to kind of keep this persona going from Comic-Con to Comic-Con, seeing all these people having to fill these huge shoes? Do you feel like it weighs on you, or?
No, I, this is interesting because up until maybe 4 or 5 months ago, I didn't really acknowledge or understand that. And Aaron would send me the feedback. He'd send me feedback from his page or from YouTube, and he's like, Kevin, man, they really appreciate what you're doing. They love you. And I would look at it, and I would go, okay, that's nice. And I didn't really – it's not that I didn't embrace it. I didn't get it. And then I had a long conversation with a dear friend of mine, Andre Gordon. And Andre Gordon's he's my producing partner, and he's been encouraging me in a lot of things that I do on the other side of the camera. If you IMDb me, you'll see all of his projects as well. But he's like, Kevin, you really should embrace this. And these people, they want to hear what you have to say. Can I set up a fan page for you? So I said, sure. I didn't really, again, think much of it. And then just by putting it up there, it was 200, 400, 500, 600, and then they all started asking questions. Mm-hmm. And initially he was managing it. He's like, Kevin, they're asking you questions. Can you log in and start answering them? And the things that they were saying were so so gracious, and I was humbled by their acceptance on what we're doing. And then it was one after another after another. And then I'm answering, and it was growing, 500,000, 5,000, 10,000, 15,000. And then the light bulb went off maybe a couple of months ago when I realized that I am one of them. I'm their Batman, so to speak. I'm accessible. I'm a fanboy. And I'm their version of what Batman could and should be. Because if they say something, I listen to it. And I love it, what they have to say. And their feedback is the word that I use most often is humbling. The fact that I'm doing what I love, I'm working with a group of people that I just adore in a genre that I was raised in and that I was built for, and for someone to write in and say, this is the best thing that I've ever seen, is, to me, a dream come true. I'm humbled, and I embrace all of that. And I get my place in all of this, this niche, this small little crevice of this mythology, is that I am their accessible Batman. I'm your accessible Batman. Do I have a good voice? I think I've got a good Batman voice. And do I carry well? I think so. But more than anything, I'm accessible. I'm yours. And we're out there, and we're showing the big boys how it's done.
There you go.
And that's what I love, because there's no separation. And also, somebody mentioned it to me. I think it was Nicole from Batman the Sun. She said there's this decentralization of the studio's power. And I loved how she said that, because now we're taking the power and we're saying, you know what? You own the license, you own the rights, but this is our Batman, and we can do whatever we want to with it. And we're creating the perfect Batman mythology. And not just me, but there are hundreds of fan films out there that are doing the same thing. And I'm sent daily fan films, and I watch them, and I just love them. And I applaud what they're doing, because they're owning and respecting. And anytime that you produce something and you set it out there into the world, you let it free, it belongs to the public. Good or bad, positive or negative, it belongs to them.
And that, those are brilliant words. I mean, that says it all. That's where the fanboys want, is that they want to be part of something bigger than themselves.
Yes, we all do.
And you provide that.
Well, as a collective,
mm-hmm.
Because Bat in the Sun is not bigger than the fans. Bat in the Sun, we are the fans.
Exactly. You know, one thing that I had that I wanted to ask you was, you mentioned how you didn't realize it till recently how big this was and how it affects other people. And in you got into theater and acting as a passion for yourself. And I'm pretty sure now being able to go ahead and travel through, to the cons, seeing all these fans, seeing the impact that you've made on all these lives, because just showing up as Batman, being that character, it's not only you being there as Batman, but you're representing, a brand, an icon, and you haven't changed. You see, one thing that I noticed is that when they rebooted the whole Batman movies and Christian Bale did his take on Batman, everybody does a different take on Batman. He did the rough voice, so now it's like everybody traditionally hears the Batman rough voice, but not necessarily that wasn't always like that. You've kept this character and you've made him yours. It hasn't changed. How do you keep yourself unsaturated from all this stuff that goes on around you? How do you keep Batman as your Batman?
But my Batman is organic. It comes from within, and the voice is a place that I go within myself, and it's literally a physical mechanism that's manifested by this emotional place. It's very difficult to do the voice when you're speaking of pedestrian things. You have to get into the mindset of Batman. So, I would say I was influenced by Keaton, completely by Keaton. I am blessed with a comparison to Conroy, and that means a great deal. But it's not as if I am doing a Conroy impression. I was more mostly influenced by Keaton. And I'm also blessed with maybe a more dynamic range than he physically has vocally. So I'm able to bring that to it. But the physicality of it to me is when you put the suit on, and I'm influenced by, and I've said this before, Neil Adams Batman from the 70s, and it was what I was raised reading. And when I look at Batman, when I look at him, I'm like, that's what I want to be, and that's what I want to sculpt my body to be. That's what I want to look like when I wear the suit. And the way that he moved, or the way that I envisioned that he would move. Whenever I speak, when the 89 came out, mm-hmm. My voice may be a little squeaky. So, I'm talking like this, and I'm Batman. And I'm like, okay, that didn't work. And you tweak it, and you find it, and then all of a sudden, you get into the sweet spot. And you're like, oh, okay, that works. I like that. That feels good. But it just feels you've got this ledge that's floating on your, at the bottom of your vocal cords, and it's supported by your diaphragm, and you can rock right through it. And it's not my speaking voice, but when I had the suit on, boom, you go straight into it.
And that just gave me chills, man. I'm telling you, Kevin, I'm sitting here on the other side in 3D. It just gave me chills.
Kevin Conroy story that I was doing an appearance, and it was for the – it was up in Times Square, and it was at the Toys R Us in Times Square, which is an amazing toy store, and I've done appearances there many times. It was a red carpet appearance, and Jim Lee was there, Kevin Conroy was there, and I was making an appearance as Batman. We had a Catwoman there, which is amazing. And so we're on the red carpet, and we're at the step and repeat, and it's me and Kevin Conroy, Jim Lee, and getting picture with, you know, the voice of Batman, and then Batman. I have to admit, I'm a little nervous, and I say, I appreciate your work. And he looked at me, kind of like, okay. And then he narrowed his eyes, and I saw this physiological change in him. And I looked into his eyes, and something shifted, and the smile was gone, and he leaned in, and he went, thank you. Oh. And I geeked out. I was like, holy smokes.
Awesome.
I wanted to give the guy a hug, but there were tens of thousands of cameras around. And so it's so funny that thank you was such a gift to me.
But, you know, it's funny because it's – when you think about it, we're all fanboys. I mean, here you are playing iconic Batman, and, you know, this is a great interview for me because I'm a personal fan, you know, and probably a lot of people listening in are you know, they're going nuts right now. But here's your moment of being a total geek and being like, ah, Kevin Conroy.
Yeah, yeah. The biggest compliment that people will give me is to say that that my characterization reminds of McConroy. It really is, because it's not anything that I would even be arrogant enough to try. But to say that is amazing to me. And I say the word humbling over and over, but it is a gift. So when people say it, I'm just like, oh, I have to reread it. And I can't thank them enough. And I respond to everything. Because if someone writes in, if someone takes the time to appreciate the work, then absolutely, I need them to know that we appreciate them. And I just thank everyone, because it means so much to me.
The workout, because, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it must be taxing on you. It you know, you have to keep up appearances. What's the quote-unquote Batman workout like? I mean, what do you do to stay in shape?
It's pretty extreme, but you have to love the work that you put in. And again, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a cosplayer, and I want to touch on that in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I said that your body is as much a costume piece as your cape. And if you are bold enough to pull up or put on spandex or Lycra, then your body becomes a piece of the uniform, of the costume. And so you should work at it. And, my workouts are extreme, and I love doing it. I work out at Gold's Gym in North Hollywood, and it's not hard to get into the zone when you're around all of these people, because they're all in the industry, they're all supportive, they're all making it happen. And I do cardio in the morning, I do weights in the afternoon. My diet is relatively strict. I'm on the larger end right now, purposely, because – you know, my Batman is a big Batman, so I'm probably 245, maybe 250. And I lift heavy, and I get a lot of response, and I get a lot of inquiries on my workouts. And I just say the most important thing is diet, mm-hmm. Cardio, and then weight in order. And then I would put rest in there as well. But diet's the most important thing, and then cardio. You have to be in shape. You have to be fit. You have to feel good about yourself. You have to be able to move well. And then when all of those factors are in line, then let's start talking about building some muscle.
So we're not talking about McDonald's for breakfast, Burger King for lunch, and Wendy's for dinner.
Okay. I'm not going to say that you may not see me there once in a room, because you do. You have to live. You have to enjoy life. And you'll, on any given afternoon, you'll see me at In-N-Out eating their protein burger. but I reward myself, and then I work it off. I live, I enjoy life, And you can't be fanatical. I don't believe in extremes. I don't believe in fanaticism. You just have to live in moderation and ramp it up a bit.
And you know what? Actually, that's great advice. And, you know, I myself have, you know, I was a huge guy and I've started working out. And one thing that I've learned is diets don't work because people go to the extreme and they forget that, you know, you have to reward yourself, even if it's just a little bit, just as long as you go ahead and you work a little harder to get that off. Some people try, you know, just completely paleo and they try all these different things, but it's all about moderation. It's all about loving yourself enough to say, today I'm going to work out and it hurts, but at the end result, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You have to enjoy the process. And I mentioned that earlier, but you have to enjoy the steps and the journey and the process. I love going into the gym. I love putting my headphones on. I love making myself better. And more than anything, if you log the hours and you work on the diet and you do the cardio, you'll see the results. And then the end result is you step out and you're wearing that suit and people say, dang, wow, that's Batman. And that's not just saying, okay, putting the cheeseburger down, throwing the suit on. That is a combination and a buildup of thousands of hours of preparation that go into being that perfect Batman. So it's not just the voice and the height and the chin and the eyes and the cape and the amazing. And I have to give a shout out to Reeves FX for his artistry in making the cowl and the gauntlets and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's Reevz FX, by the way. But it's a team that goes into making this what I view as the perfect Batman, and I need to put my time into it, and that's the research about the character. It's the emotional research, getting to that place, and then also it's logging the physical hours in the gym and also abstaining from what you need to abstain from.
Now, you did mention that you wanted to touch upon cosplay and that you were working on a project.
Cosplay is interesting because recently that word has been thrown around and in regarding, and I'm like, okay, I didn't know what it meant. I had no idea what cosplay meant. I thought it was like Heroclix or something. I didn't know what it meant. So I Googled it. And I'm like, oh, okay.
That's where Wang gets most of his information from anywhere, Google. You know? That's where he got his degree from. So
that's right.
I Wikipedia'd it, and I found out that it's the wonderful people, the wonderful enthusiasts, the wonderful artists that just love the process of costuming. I'm like, okay, these are my people. Mm-hmm. And I applaud them because these are the people that, going back to my early days of the early 2000s, when I would see at Comic-Con and I'm there and I'm getting paid and I've got a suite and I've got a trailer and I'm taken care of, and these guys are busting their butts and they're changing in the restroom and they're sweating and they're walking around the suits all day and they're doing it for the love and the passion of it, and they're not getting paid, and to me that made them exponentially more noble than me. Bigger than I am. And so I embrace and I applaud them, and I'm like, oh, okay. And to be even peripherally associated with that group is such an honor. It's such an honor. And they're so talented, and so much more so as we move along. There's a project that I segue into it. The Adam J. Project, I think superhero photography, and this is something that I was approached to do a month or two ago, and Bat in the Sun is co-producing it, and it is this epic photo shoot with all of the iconic Justice League characters and villains, and also shooting a teaser, and all of the suits are originally produced, and there's some budget behind it. There was a pretty big Kickstarter campaign that was extremely successful. And I went on the page, and I would highly recommend, and if you guys could put a link on it, that would be wonderful.
No, absolutely.
And I looked at all the people that were involved, and some I knew, like Josh Boltinghouse, who played Superman, who's spectacular, Paul Molnar, who's Joker, but then there were a bunch of other names and links to their fan pages, and these people are so talented and so amazing, and they look so incredible in the suits that I'm just honored to be a part of this project with them. I can't wait to stand beside them. And these are all just brilliant fanboys and girls that just have nothing but raw talent and raw passion. And they're good looking people. That helps. It does. That goes a long way as well. But I can only imagine how incredible we'll all look together. So the cosplay community, I'm honored to be associated with them. And the Adam J. Project, I would highly recommend and check that out, because it's a gift that Adam is giving to the world, and he's going through a lot of effort for it. He's no expenses are spared on that.
And this is great. I'm actually like I said, you'll be able to go ahead and click these links. They're all going to be included with this. And support. This is the best thing that we can do, and this is something that I preach all the time, either through my Facebook page or on my Twitter account. Guys, you hear it all the time. Support all your independent projects, because it's these people who are out there, trying to live their dream, trying to make all this come true, that they're trying to give us a gift. Mm-hmm. So we really need to support them and support their effort. And really help them kind of, because that's what they're doing. They're really trying to go ahead and bring us something, their vision of something that we want to see.
On one hand, it's free entertainment. And on the other hand, a lot of times we're doing it a lot better than the big boys are. And support to me means an attaboy, great job, like everyone does. And then sometimes in Adam's case, it's donating $5 or $2 or $1. $1, if someone goes to the trouble to log in and donate $1, I just want to hug them. I can't believe that people believe in what we're doing so much. And that means a great deal. And so whether it's $5, $1, whatever, they add up for Adam. And like I said, when you click on it, you're going to be very excited about what we're doing. And I think we shoot in February on that. So there's plenty of time.
And so, there's plenty of time to go out there and support. The links are going to be there available below. And one more thing, Kevin, I know that, with the whole new Batman movie, Batman Superman movie, the crossover that's happening now, just another thing that I thought was fantastic was you had some fans go out there and they really petitioned hard to try to get you to play the new Batman.
Yeah, that was very nice. That was really nice. And my agent was on it as well, but I knew, and they were stunt casting, they were star casting, and they went after it immediately. And I knew, and I don't want to say that talent didn't come into play, but they knew that they would go after someone that was a built-in franchise. Mm-hmm. And that would be Ben Affleck. Even I was hoping for Josh Brolin or John Hamm. I thought those guys would be great because they have this edginess, this darkness to them.
Josh Brolin would have been amazing.
Yes, especially Frank Miller's version, because he's grizzled. He would have to lose the accent, but I'm sure that he'd be fine.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Bruce Wayne with a twang doesn't work. I worked with Ben on Daredevil, and that was 10 years ago, and that was a different Ben. He was nice. He was younger. He was a blast on set, but he wasn't mature enough for Daredevil, much less Batman. But the Batman that we're getting is the Ben Affleck of the town, who was brilliant, from Argo, who was, he was less brilliant as an actor, but he was more mature. And, my expectations are high, and it's Batman, and it's an actor following directions wearing suit, period.
Exactly.
So there's no single actor that's bigger than the project. So let's cut Ben some slack and put more trust in Snyder, and let's see what he can do.
And you know what? I really appreciate that. And coming, from somebody who plays an icon like Batman and is as respected as you are in the community, hearing that, it's you're giving respect to Ben Affleck as a grown actor. Like you said, in Daredevil, he hadn't matured yet as an actor. He's done a lot of different things. He's shown us that he's got a bit of a caliber, but people are still trying to hold him responsible for a character he was, over 10 years ago.
It's funny. I did an interview last week, and I mentioned that I didn't realize how bad Daredevil stunk. I thought it was great. Because the only time I'd seen it was at the premiere, and all I'm doing is looking for myself.
And, of course.
And it was like my prom, and so I didn't leave going, oh, that was horrible. And so I hadn't seen it since, and kind of it went by unnoticed, relatively forgotten. And then when all this hoopla, and I kind of took it personally because that was a project that I was proud of. I'm like, did Daredevil, did it stink? Was it really that bad? And so I was caught off guard with how poorly it was received 10 years after the fact.
No, you said you know it's a project that you were proud of, right? What about Dodgeball?
Dodgeball is an interesting project because first of all, the staying power of that movie is incredible. It's as much a cult classic as anything.
Yes.
I do 4 to 6 events a year, live appearances as Laser with Blazer, with Michelle, just making appearances, signing softball tournaments. And it was an incredible experience. I was talking to the same friend of mine last night that it's been 10 years this week that we're shooting Dodgeball. Not this week. I shot it for like 3 months, but at this time, 10 years ago, I was shooting Dodgeball, and it was clearly the best time of my life. I was in an amazing place. I was doing what I loved. I was hanging out with some of the best names in the industry, and when it came out, that was my first taste of success. I mean, boom, it hit 100 million quickly, and number one for a couple of weeks. It was number one comedy for like a month, and then boom, DVDs and what have you, and I was on posters on Sunset Boulevard. It was crazy. Times Square. It was an amazing time in my life. And then I thought, okay, well, then that's gone. Let's move on. But in that way, it's just I get texts daily. Hey, I'm watching you on FX. FX runs that literally every day, it seems like. So I'm blessed with my involvement in that. And I'm torn to whether what it's going to say of my Greystone, dear life, Kevin Laser Porter or Kevin Batman Porter. I'm not quite sure which one it'll be, and either one.
You know, it's Kevin Batman Porter, a.k.a. Laser.
There you go.
Problem solved.
That would be perfect, but not for some time.
Exactly.
Yeah. To this day, I still check my cable trying to find ESPN 8, the Ocho.
The Ocho. I went to Gary Cole the other day up at the gym, and he from Dodgeball, and it's the first time I've seen him in a few years, and he's like, man, can you believe that movie? And I'm like, I know, and it just won't go away in such an amazing way. Someone sent me a link to actually 6 or 7 links of people that dress up as Dodgeball, as the Purple Cobras for Halloween. And you to see someone portraying you on Halloween the same way that I would portray a Batman is crazy. And you'll have him go, and he's like, yeah, I'm Laser. I'm like, wow, that's me. He's dressing up as me. It's crazy.
It's like an Inception. You know, it's like it's you playing a character in a movie who's being played by another person who's playing you in a character in a movie.
He's doing his interpretation of you.
Exactly.
It's a blessing because I'm just a dude. I'm Kevin. I'm just a dude who is blessed to have these crazy experiences. I'm almost like a tall Forrest Gump that's just fiddling and just stumbling my way through life, having these amazing experiences.
Well, we're about to give you an amazing experience, Kevin. Right now, you're going to go ahead and play a game that we like to call Fun with Wang. I'll go ahead and let Wang do the specifics on this, because I always say it, and then he repeats it again like a small child. So, Wang, take it away.
Hey, this is Wang, so we're going to go into Fun with Wang here, Kevin Porter. And I've got some questions for you, Kevin. We'll ask 5 trivia questions and maybe test your knowledge of some subjects that are familiar to you. So, and this is in 3D, by the way, so everybody got your glasses on. So, you ready to play, Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So what actor was originally offered the role of Batman for the films?
For the films, which one are we talking about?
For 1980,
no. Oh, the be-all and all. I believe that, interestingly enough, Bill Murray was offered that role and turned it down, thankfully.
What are you talking about? I mean, I would have loved to have seen Bill Murray.
You know, it would have been, to me, it would have been very Green Hornet-esque. So,
that is true. It is Bill Murray, and I kind of agree with you, Kevin. Yeah, it would have probably turned into a Green Hornet comedy slash. It went down the funny angle, I'm afraid.
It would have been interesting. Don't get me wrong. I love Bill Murray. Bill Murray's done a lot of different things from going from his comedic side to now a very dramatic side. And I agree with you, Kevin. I can't see him playing Batman. I just can't. And I mean, I don't know what Tim Burton would have done to that.
He doesn't have, I say the chin, and eventually he's going to have to take that mask off, and that's not anything we want to see. And I'm not saying that Michael Keaton is a looker, but he pulls off Bruce Wayne really well. I just can't see. That's not in Bill Murray's wheelhouse.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, since you are a Batman, expert, for lack of a better term, knowledge base. And casting, let's go to our another question here. What famous actress was originally offered Catwoman for the Batman movies?
Interestingly enough, Annette Bening was offered that role, but I believe she had to turn it down because she was pregnant with Warren Beatty's first child. She was first coming off of either Buffy or the movie Grifters, but she was originally offered the role of Catwoman, and I think she would have been great. However, it went to Michelle Pfeiffer, and I think she spun it into a totally different direction.
You know what? That's interesting, because Annette Bening, I mean, if you think about it, this is two things that Warren Beatty has ruined for me, because he ruined Dick Tracy, and now this. I'm heartbroken. I'm going to need a couple moments to myself after this to get over this. So,
well, let me touch on Dick Tracy a bit. I think Dick Tracy at the time was a stinker, but I think looking back, I think it kind of holds up in the genre that it was meant to be. It's a tough movie to pull off. It really is. But when you watch it now, if you kind of extract Madonna out of it, it's not bad. it's okay.
You know, but the thing is, my problem was I don't see Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy. I love the colors. I love how bright everything was. How cartoony, I guess, quote unquote. You know, and I'm doing the quotations in 3D. But
I prefer the word stylized.
Stylized. There you go. It was very stylized. I could see the movie. I enjoyed it, but I didn't enjoy Warren Beatty that much in it, or Madonna.
Well, he's pretty flat. I think that's his style is flat, and it works for some characters. I think this was a passion project for him, mm-hmm. and you're right. I think he was maybe probably a bit mature for the role. I think he was a bit flat. If it were done today, I think it'd be a little darker. But also, this was not long after, because I'm guessing the movie came out in 90, 91, maybe. And so it was when those movies were in that style, that kind of cartoony style. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good watch now after we have, 20 years of forgiveness. But I remember being disappointed when I saw it.
And on behalf of all the Warren Beatty fans, I'm still waiting for Ishtar 2.
Me too.
All of our listeners are Googling the movie Ishtar right now.
Don't Google it. You'll break the internet.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I am a Warren Beatty fan. I'm a Dustin Hoffman fan. It was unfortunate. But for every Ishtar, you'll have a Hemingway, you'll have a Red. So
let's keep on with trivia with Kevin here. In the original Batman 1989 film, staying in 25 years ago here.
So a lot of people ago. Ask me what my favorite is, and it's hands down 89, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's a fantastic film. And over in that film, what actor played Harvey Dent?
Ah, the original Harvey Dent, who created other iconic characters, Lando Calrissian, and also played Gale Sayers in the Brian song.
That's right. Yeah.
And that would be Billy Dee Williams, the incomparable Billy Dee Williams. It's interesting because he also played it in Batman Forever. I don't think that he was in Batman and Robin. I don't remember much about that movie.
Not a lot of us do.
But I remember going, gosh, so he's going to play Two-Face. Interesting. And to tell you the truth, I wish that actually, no, he wasn't in Batman Forever because that was Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones, yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones.
No, Tommy Lee Jones was in. He was in Batman and Robin. That's why Billy Dee wasn't. I thought Tommy Lee Jones was horrendous. Horrendous. I think he was stepping outside of his comfort zone, outside of his wheelhouse. And so I would have much more preferred seeing Billy Dee in that role. And it's funny because it was the character that he kind of created in one, built on it in two, and then was replaced in three.
Go figure.
Right.
Kind of like Dennis Howard.
Yeah.
All right. Well, keeping up with trivia, Fun with Wang, more trivia here. Kevin Porter, in the game of dodgeball, the actual rules, a team consists of how many players and how many substitutes?
Okay. Let me go off of my experience. So there was Laser, Blazer, Blade, Michelle, Fran, 6. Wow, we only had 6 with no substitutes.
It's because guys were awesome.
Yeah.
You guys were awesome. That's right.
So,
yeah.
I would say I'm going to say 6 players, and I'm going to guess and say 3 substitutes, even though we had none.
That's a good guess, but the correct answer is 4 substitutes. 6 players, 4 substitutes. But I did find it interesting. Your team had no substitutes.
Wait. What if you're really good?
You guys were really good. That's why you didn't have any substitutes.
Okay, that would be a bylaw, we like to say.
I'm just going by the official dodgeball rules, you know, that are out there. And today's final question on Fun with Wang, I rarely get to ask soap opera questions on this show, so when I get the chance, I'm going to hit it out of the park. A Luke and Laura fan, Kevin Porter was, and in this day and age of ratings, how many people watched Luke and Laura's Wedding, the one-hour episode? And again, this is pre-DVR, you know, so it's actually amazing.
That big, fat, hairy guess and say 52 million.
That's a huge guess, but the answer unofficially is 30 million. And
to be within 22 million to me was a victory.
Yeah, I mean, you think about that nowadays. I mean, 30 million people watching a daytime broadcast was amazing. That's how big that event was. And, you know, I agree. My sister, my mom, my aunt, everybody was watching it. So me being all of 13 years old, I watched it as well when I got out of school. So yes. It was a monumental event in television history.
I was right there with you. I was right there with you crying along the way.
And, you know, and that's the thing. It's like you just think about how many people went home sick that day and how much, you know, just mass chaos happened in society, but we all got back together the next day, and we fixed it. Now all the rights were wrong in the world.
The GNP of the nation dipped that day. Absolutely. And again, it's funny that you've got this kid who's sitting cross-legged in front of the television, watching Luke and Laura get married, much to the disdain of his father, and saying one day, I'm going to be on that show. And there I was, and I love being literally a proponent for if you see it, you can be it. If you dream it, make it happen, and no excuses. And all I can do is speak from experience, and the fact that I was in Port Charles. My character's name was Bog, and I worked for Helena Cassidine, so I was like the bad guy, and I would go around and I would harass Lucky and Elizabeth, and I would look for the Ice Princess, and all these storylines that I was raised with. And so, you know, all of your listeners out there, it doesn't matter what they want to do, what they want to be, whether it's a promotion or a job or whether they want to be Batman or a movie star, whatever. Just, you know, make a plan and you know, bust your butt and make it happen. No excuses.
Those are wise words coming from a well-versed, well-lived man, a man who's, you know, made no excuses and has always been a constant watcher, and that's the most important thing. Is not only do you, you know, go out there and live your dream, Kevin, but you go ahead and meet people, ask questions, always asking questions, always saying, well, how does this done? How is that done? because the more you know, the more you absorb, and you use that earlier like a sponge. The more you absorb, the more you learn, the more you grow as a person, as an individual.
I think another wise man said, and knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe.
There you go.
Well, Kevin, on behalf of all our listeners, behalf of me and the Great Wang, I want to thank you for being on your show. I know that you're a busy man.
I just want to say that where I am in this community, let's say the Batman community, because that's the one that brought me to this dance today, I couldn't be more appreciative, more humbled, more in tune with the supporters out there, the work of what we all do. And we're all in this together. We're all fans, and we're all making art. And whether that art is sending in feedback, sending in drawings, making your own fan films, dressing up, or what have you, and we all need to come together. And I think that we're at a great place now through, you know, the great show Big Bang Theory, which I love, and it's a celebration and glee, and it's a celebration of expression, and it's these great unsung people which we're all a part of. And make no mistake, I'm taller. But I'm still just as big of a geek as anyone out there.
and that's great. That's great advice for all our listeners out there. And Kevin, thank you so much for spending this time with us and letting us into your world.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And keep doing what you guys are doing, because you guys are awesome.
Oh, thank you. Right there, we get an endorsement from Batman.
I've seen all of your work.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much. And once again, for Beach Bum Comics, I am Deadpool Speaks, and with me as always is the Great Wang. And Kevin Porter, thank you so much.
All right, buddy. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening this week. And remember, just like always, we will be back next week with another great guest and more adventures from the land of Chimichanga Talk. So tune in next time, same Deadpool time, same Deadpool channel.
You're listening to this podcast in Grand Theft Auto 5, you know, because if you turn to that special radio station while you're still that car, or pay close attention in the VIP room there in the strip club, because we're playing in the background.
I jumped off a mountain earlier and died, and as I was falling, I heard Deadpool Speaks.
We are just an Easter egg within the game.
We are. We are an Easter egg within an Easter egg in the game.